Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On Game of Thrones Season 3. For more information and news we talk about in the show, go to our website at www.geekson.com. Hey, everybody.
Hello, my geeklings.
Welcome to another episode of Geeks On.
Another episode of Geeks On. We're bringing an old interview back, and so we wanted to do a wraparound.
It's a Geeks On classic.
It's kind of a Geeks On classic, although I think we're going to be talking about all sorts of new stuff.
I always liked Cherry Geeks On a little bit more.
Cherry Geeks On?
Yeah, Cherry Geeks On is so much better.
That sounds naughty.
What's the deal with all these sodas trying to market diet drinks to men in the most, like, idiotic way possible?
What are you talking about?
It's diet extreme. It's diet for you, not for her.
Yeah, they've got these, like, diet sodas that
I know nothing about this.
Really? Yeah.
It's nothing.
Fucking everywhere. I don't even understand it. It's like,
I mean, is there really...
It's Dr. Pepper, not for you. If not for her, it's for you.
Yeah, I mean, really? Is there really, like... Is somebody, like, worried about how gay they look with a Diet Coke?
I don't really know that being a factor for anybody.
I know. I mean, it's like, it seems crazy to me.
I don't think gay men are worried about looking gay with a Diet Coke.
I don't think straight men are.
Exactly. I don't think anybody cares how they look with a Diet Coke.
Well, my name is Aaron Hendricks, and I'm a graphic designer and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I'm a geek.
And he drinks Diet Coke.
And I drink Diet Coke.
My name is Matt King. I'm an actor and filmmaker here in Los Angeles, and I, too, am a geek. I do not drink Diet Coke. I just drink water.
My name is Donald Marshall. I am a video game professional here in sunny Hollywood, and I, too, am a geek, and I like iced tea.
Welcome, everybody. This is also another all-Skype episode.
While we're on the subject of soda, explain to me the half-assed I-can't-commit-to-diet soft drink phenomenon now of the 10-calorie soft drink.
Okay, actually... I didn't know that there actually was one, but I was thinking about this the other day. I cannot stand diet sodas. I actually don't drink Diet Coke. They're disgusting.
I can't stand soda in general, but Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi are a particular brand of disgusting. It was always funny because I'd be writing with Peter, and Peter drinks Diet Coke like it's going out of fashion. And they would be sitting there on the table, and every once in a while I'd just get thirsty, and I'd just grab his soda and drink from it. And I'd always go, oh, God, why did I do that? Because it's terrible.
Well, what I was thinking is, you know, the other day I was like, I just mixed some Diet Coke with regular Coke, and it wasn't as bad. And I'm thinking, well, this is half the calories. So why do I have to get zero all the time? Just give me enough calories so it tastes good, but not 150 calories a can.
God.
Like, do I really need do I really need to drink zero freaking calories? Just let it be like, you know, 30 calories. It, you know, it tastes better than Diet Coke, but I'm getting my 30 calories. I mean, is hitting zero really that important?
Do we really need another entire brand for that?
How about just Diet Coke that tastes good? Just let's call it that. I'll drink that.
How about Coke and it has real sugar in it and you just don't drink it to excess?
How about an eight ounce serving of it?
You both are communists. That's not the American way.
I know. Okay. How about the old glass soda bottle?
Let's get back onto the geeky subject here before our people hate us.
We should be talking about Mountain Dew, not this Diet Coke stuff.
Right. Did anybody have a geek week at all?
What did I do? I finished my taxes, so no.
I went and saw Oz. What'd you think? I did not like it, by the way.
I was actually surprisingly put off by Mila Kunis's cleavage. The fact that they had to make
I never thought I would hear. I know.
It's very odd, but the fact that they made the Wicked Witch of the West sexy Wicked Witch of the West, I was looking at the trailers and just thinking it was like a bad Halloween costume.
That is at that is, there's nothing, that's not the problem with this at all. I mean, in fact, that wouldn't even cross my mind as being the problem with this film.
That is the grain of sand on the beach of problems with this film.
Well, the acting is absolutely atrocious from absolutely everybody. And the dialogue is absolutely atrocious. So it's even hard to tell if they even had a chance. And the way the plot unravels is a real shame, because there is a basis, a base idea that could have been cool.
Well, he wrote like, what is it, 30 books or something like that, all set in the Land of Oz.
So, I don't think this is actually.
Is this an L. Frank Baum? They drawing from L. Frank Baum?
From what I understand is that fans of the books are will not go see this because it is not like the books.
Ah.
The visuals are very cool, and I saw it in 3D. And it was a good 3D experience. It didn't hurt. In fact, it felt like a ride. And its best moments were kind of okay, I'm not in a movie. I'm in a Disney ride, really. Which is sad, because you went to go try to see a good story, and what you're really getting is a motion ride is almost what it felt like. But that stuff was cool. But in general, I mean, I kept checking my watch because my clock, because I was hoping it was going to be over soon. I mean, I was pretty bored.
That's bad.
The ending, there's kind of a scheme that, the big plan that the good guys come up with to save the day, I thought was, interesting in its 3D and kind of spectacle way, because it's all about spectacle. And in a theater, it came over well. It did, that part was at least, I thought, exciting. But the movie sucked. I mean, it's not good. So don't see it, kids.
Don't see it. Well, it actually did incredibly well in the theaters, and I was in line for something, and I heard these three ladies talking about it like it was the second coming. So,
have they seen it yet?
Yeah, no, they had seen it, and were talking about having gone seen it with their kids, and absolutely adored it. So,
well, okay.
Aaron is out of sync with Middle America.
You know, the other thing that's weird.
I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked at that statement. Totally blown away, and I'm saying that completely sarcastically.
The other thing, you know, that's. Because the look comes from a lot from the movie, I don't think it was just illustrations that they've found, you know, that's inspired by the book. So a lot of it comes right out of the other movie. It feels strange that it's not a musical.
Oh, because the other one was?
Yeah, and the other one, it worked so well as a musical. I felt like I was missing that in this.
I've heard that a lot of people who've watched it felt like they were trying to replace the musical set pieces with special effects set pieces, and it didn't quite work.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, not much more to say about that.
Speaking of movies and releases, the Sid the Science Kid movie just came out, and I am one of the main characters in it. So you can go check me out as Yang Yang. In the Sid the Science Kid movie that's coming out.
And, so they liked your name.
I'm sorry, Matt. What was that name?
It was Yang Yang, Don, just to clarify. Yang Yang.
Yang Yang?
Yes.
Are you, in fact, playing a panda, Matt? Because that is really the only acceptable character that can have that name. if you are not, in fact, gnawing on bamboo when I go to see you in this movie, I'm going to have big concerns.
My
wife thought it was cute. But the female character who's with me is named Niu Niu. So it's Yang Yang and Niu Niu. Yeah. So.
Well, to be honest, there are a lot of Chinese names like that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, Pei Pei Wei Wei. I mean, yeah. I know several people with those names. So.
They know bamboo.
Also, Also, what was it? BioShock Infinite just came out, and I am one of the characters in there as well. So
I will be picking that up tomorrow, which would be Tuesday. This will probably be out on Wednesday. But yes, I am looking forward to it. It got a great review on Game Trailers, which I looked at today. And I'm hoping I get the at least a similar experience from than when I played BioShock, because I love that game too.
Did you skip
my two? Surest signs of my advanced age is me getting text messages from GameStop saying, "We've got your copy of BioShock coming in at midnight," and me going like, "Midnight? That's late. I'm not going in some midnight to pick up a video game. I'm not. How old do you think I am? Get off my lawn, you youngsters. With your crazy newfangled video games at midnight."
I actually have BioShock 2, and I started playing it, and it just felt too samey to me, and so I stopped playing that.
Too same?
Well, I enjoyed
what
it.
Do you mean?
Well, it just felt like, BioShock 1.
It did feel, the gameplay felt very similar. However, the story elements to me actually felt very flip side. I actually really quite enjoyed the contrast of story.
And that's one where you kind of wake up as a big daddy, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but like one felt very libertarian, one felt very socialist.
that seems to be their shtick, because they love that type of stuff.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, maybe, yeah. I did finish Tomb Raider, and it's a great.
Was it gory all the way to the end?
It is super gory, and it is very violent. Again, I still feel, I've mentioned it last time, I still feel that it is contrary to the feel of a traditional Tomb Raider, and that part bothered me a bit. But the game is great. It really is fun. I still wish there were more tombs.
Having picked up sorry, go on.
No, the last thing was I saw Wreck-It Ralph, and I'm coming late to the party. I don't know, understand how it beat Brave at the Oscars. I have no idea. Anyway, that's me being 3 months behind the times.
Brave beat it.
Yeah, sorry, I don't understand how Brave beat it.
Yeah,
I'm totally on board with you.
But yeah, people love Wreck-It Ralph. It got great, great at least reviews from all my friends.
It's genius. Genius.
Brave was very sweet and nice, and I don't disparage it, but Wreck-It Ralph was wonderful.
Yeah.
Anybody have any geek news?
I got one. So, Aaron's body draino may be here. Basically, I have this picture in front of me, and one's of this inordinately obese mouse. I mean, it looks like a ball with a nose. And on the left is a skinny mouse. And basically it says, the obese mouse on the right was fed a high-fat diet. The mouse on the left was fed the same diet, but is at normal weight after receiving something called Amlozanix. Researchers at the University of Michigan's Life Sciences Institute have found that I can't pronounce it, an off-patent drug currently prescribed for the treatment of asthma and other uses, also reverses obesity, diabetes, and fatty liver in mice.
Wow.
So it's body draino. It's literally this asthma drug that completely reverses obesity. It's bizarre.
Well, what it also needs to do is remove plaque from the arteries.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it does that.
It says, one of the reasons that diets are so ineffective in producing weight loss for some people is that their bodies adjust to the reduced calorie by also reducing their metabolism so that they're defending their body weight, Saltiel said.
Right.
Amlozanix seems to tweak the metabolic response to excessive calorie storage in mice. So, yeah.
Well,
they got to do a case study on humans, and you know.
So right now skinny mice. We're going to see more skinny mice now.
A lot more skinny mice. Absolutely. Yeah.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. All good.
I hate those big mice. this is something that's not news to anybody, but I just wanted to talk about it real quickly. The Clone Wars was canceled.
What?
Oh. Really? That's news to me.
It's been canceled, and it looks like...
By Disney?
Well, yeah, by Disney. I don't know if the, I've looked around and I can't see any statement as the reason why, but it also looks like they're really not going to give it the chance to wrap up the storylines.
Wow.
So it makes me think that it wasn't making money. It was cost too much money, and maybe it was just a Lucas pet project. I mean, we knew from day one, because we knew people who worked there, that they started working on this and got a full season. Season one was done before they found anybody to actually air the episodes. And George Lucas pretty much said, I want to do this, and I'm doing it, you know, no matter what, even if, you know, if I have to sell it myself. So... who knows? It may have been just kind of a lost program, you know, a lost program.
Well, I know for a fact that they've been recording season six. So,
well, they have episodes in the can and they're very far ahead. But yeah. I think that the production of new episodes is not hasn't been ordered, which means that they wouldn't have time to sum up and clear up these story arcs that they've been building for 6 years.
Wow.
So I think a lot of fans are upset that you know that they didn't give them at least time to you know, in these storylines.
Wow.
So who knows? I mean, there's a lot of episodes, I think, probably in the can. I mean, they really do these way far in advance. But there is, you know, there is another theory that people have been batting around, that Disney is trying to kind of clear the Star Wars pipes,
yeah,
to kind of start fresh with their content. And so they don't have the stigma of the Clone Wars and the first three movies. And that they can continue on with kind of a more clean palette. Meaning, I'm wondering if they'll do that with, you know, video games, comics, books. Just kind of make sure that they get control and hold on all these things that are all over the place.
Yeah, it looks like they're also putting a pause on Seth Green's new series, Star Wars Detours.
Which was the comedy...
comedy Star Wars.
Star Wars. Did you just look that up or something?
I just looked that up, yeah. So, yeah, Star Wars The Clone Wars ends as an ongoing series while Detours is delayed. Supposedly, they're going to take the additional content and start foisting it off in other places in four-episode arcs.
That's so interesting. Have those things already had a distributor?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Dave Filoni, who's sort of the creator of Clone Wars, basically said, there are more stories to tell, and as I've said, we've been working on them for a while. There won't be a sixth season, but the announcement did promise we're continuing production on new Clone Wars story arcs that promise to be some of the most thrilling adventures ever seen. Stay tuned for more information on where fans can soon find this bonus content. So it looks like they don't have a provider yet, but isn't it? Only question is where they'll be on TV. Disney XD looks to be likely, or straight to DVD. Who knows?
Interesting. Well, you know, I think there, I mean, Disney had mentioned, I think, and this could be rumor. It's kind of hard to tell when you read so much crap on the internet if it's BS or not. And I can't remember where I read this, but they had already said that they were going to maybe do another animated series, a new one. Mm-hmm. And so they may just be shifting the team from Clone Wars, keeping them, you know, staffed up and ready to go on this next project. I mean, I'm not sure why they would, you know, change absolutely everybody when they have a, you know, a mechanism and machine that's cranking out lots of content already. It seems like it would be efficient to keep those people.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. Very interesting.
Anybody else?
I'm just curious if Disney is going to be forced to sort of keep the Star Wars content more family-friendly as they move forward, or if they can really dare to go dark as sort of we want Star Wars to be.
Well, what's interesting is that if they put the castle on the front end of Star Wars, which is something that for some reason my brain literally just recoils from, the idea of the castle going up at the beginning of Star Wars and then you start the duh, you know. I can't do that. I always have the 20th Century Fox logo for a while. Like, I would see other films with the 20th Century Fox logo when I was a kid, and I would immediately think that Star Wars was about to start right afterwards.
Right.
I'm just sort of, it's going to be a bizarre disjoint when the castle is there. But the thing was, I was talking to a Disney lady, and she was saying basically, if we put the castle on the front of things, there are so many more rules and hoops that we have to jump through than, mm-hmm. you know, say if it's ABC or if it's Miramax. You know, Miramax is a division of Disney, and they just basically, they're hands off. So if it'll be interesting to see how they distribute Star Wars, because I think the distribution, where it's distributed, will definitively decide what those films are going to be. I mean, I hope it comes through Miramax and they go for PG-13s, you know?
I mean, does 20th Century Fox have zero say on any of this?
It's Disney's property now. They own it. Huh. Yeah, 20th Century Fox is no longer a distributor of Star Wars. You know.
Yeah, I don't know what they'll do. Right. I mean, if it has a Disney logo, they have to maintain a...
Yeah, I mean, their standards and practices, you know, for any TV show is just that much higher if you put that Disney logo on the front of it, you know? Because you put Disney logo on the front of something, and God forbid you show a boob or somebody's hand getting cut off, and it's, you know, that would be a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Well, because, I don't need to see a boob in Star Wars, but let's think about this.
Slave Leia is important to my childhood.
Well, I know, but there's no boob. I mean, okay, let's think about this. Would Disney be able to put out A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi as is?
I don't think so.
So you think they would have to tone that down?
Yes. Because even when violence has taken place in Disney films, it's always off camera.
Well, see, now you've got me. Before, I was like, I'm kind of excited about Disney finding new filmmakers and creators, and now I'm getting a little worried. You're worrying me.
I mean, I have been worried with Disney because I think that you're required to jump through. Yeah, you're just required to jump through certain hoops if you make a Disney film. Hmm. You know, I mean, just look at the difference between and the thing is like. If you look at Pixar, right? Mm-hmm. The Pixar films that Pixar was in charge of were every single one up until Brave. Brave was the first one that was Pixar as a property of Disney. So that doesn't, you know, and Brave to me was really a meh film. You know, it was beautiful, but it didn't have the same sort of story that I come to expect from a Pixar film.
But that's can't be. You're not blaming that on the fact that it wasn't edgy enough.
I'm blaming it on the fact that Disney controls story to a fairly well and is a lot of the time more worried about who something will offend than how to tell a good story.
So you don't think that they left Pixar alone on Brave?
No, I don't think they left Pixar alone on Brave, which is interesting because John Lasseter was one of the producers on Wreck-It Ralph, which I didn't realize. And I feel like they left him alone a lot more than they left the folks in Brave, because Brave had had an opportunity to really go dark and to explore some interesting psychological places and just failed on, I thought, every front.
So do you think, well, now, who did Toy Story 3? Was Disney's logo on the front of that?
It was.
See, now to me?
It was, but it was not, but that was more controlled by Pixar. Pixar was still in charge on that one.
But there's still hoops.
Right. No, absolutely.
I mean, that movie was damn dark.
Yeah, true.
All right, well, Jesus. Now I'm going to lose sleep tonight. I have another news article. Have you guys heard of this rumor about HBO doing the Game of Thrones prequel TV series?
No. What do you mean the comic book that we're talking about that was done?
Well, no, there.
Is George just like, I can't write it in time?
I mean, that's, they're kind of alluding. I mean, this to me doesn't, help anything at all. You can't just suddenly stop at season six and go, hey, guess what? We're going to do 2 years of prequels. Wow. So to me, this doesn't solve anything. But there's this rumor that HBO is considering maybe looking into some of the little short stories that George R. R. Martin did in the same universe, the Hedge Knight, the Soren Sword, yeah, and the Mystery Knight, and maybe kind of take that period, which was about 90 years before the Game of Thrones book, and maybe doing a prequel series.
I would do that, and I would put it on the web. I wouldn't even put it up on my channel until it was. I would do first release on the web. And
why?
Because HBO, because Netflix right now put out. There was one guy who did an interview, and he said we wanted to become HBO before HBO became Netflix.
Right.
Right. Because HBO right now with their streaming content is able to. I mean, they're really becoming Netflix.
So you're saying you would put an...
They need to feed HBO Go is what you're saying.
Yeah. If they need to feed HBO or if they need to create an online presence, everything is trending towards media platforms controlling more and more places where they can produce content.
But the problem with that right now...
Put it out wherever you can.
The problem with that now, though, Matt... is that HBO doesn't have the option to go exclusive right now, and so you're putting bait in a place where you're not allowed to actually get it. You have to subscribe.
Interesting.
So I agree. Like the Game of Thrones last year, if I recall correctly, was the number one pirated show on the internet.
Right.
So it's like the problem with HBO Go right now is it's too limited. Like, there isn't enough on there to really merit subscribing to any of these things that you have to, like the full subscription package to a cable in order to get HBO Go is too weighty.
Right.
Yeah, but people are paying like $34 or okay, let's say it's $20 a month for HBO right now. Would you pay $10 a month for the HBO app where you can see every single documentary and every single...
You can't just pay for the $10 a month for the HBO app. Well, you have to pay the $60 a month for the cable subscription and then $10 a month for HBO.
Well, yep. There is a rumor out there on this week that HBO is trying to figure out a way to do that.
They're going to get sued by every single cable company and every single dish provider out there because they're the number one reason why people are still subscribing to cable and dish.
Yep.
Well, yep. I'm curious, but you know,
I really hope they manage to find a way around it because I feel like it's going to force people to, you know, really. I mean, because HBO is like, well, if we have great content and people are just going to come to us for great content, then it's going to, I feel like it's going to force the market to say, well, we have to find a way to make great content to drive people to us.
They already know that. And that's why, you know, that's why Comcast and those guys buying NBC. I mean, they already know.
That's a good buy.
Well, segging into our topic. Game of Thrones is the reason why I had a goddamn cable subscription last year. Absolutely. And I paid through the nose for my darned cable.
Right.
Yep.
All right. So, well, should we lead into our discussion here?
We absolutely should.
All right. Let's do just a quick discussion because really I'm going to go and dig through our archives and pull out that interview with George R. R. Martin that we did several years ago.
Yeah.
But let's
before he... Yeah.
Yeah, that
back
was
before he was somebody,
right? And why don't we agree to keep this spoiler free somehow?
Oh, you're a monster!
How is that going to happen?
How can we make predictions about season three and not make spoilers?
Well, right. I don't know.
You tell me, Aaron, and we'll do it. You tell me.
Well, you know, one thing is.
Why don't we call it spoilerish?
We won't name any characters or possible events.
We will try our darndest.
All right. Well, how about this? Instead of doing predictions, I'm just going to say this. I have read all the books. I have probably the third book as my favorite of the books in the series.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
I really think that when I heard that they were doing Game of Thrones, and when I watch season one and watch season two, all I'm thinking about is, oh my gosh, season three and four are going to be crazy.
Yep.
And it's because, without spoiler alerts, this is the book, and I think everybody knows that they're actually splitting this book into two seasons,
right?
Which is good.
And merging some of book four into
which is also good. Which is also good.
Also smart, because that's the way it should have been done.
Some of the most significant things that happen in this whole story happens in this book. And it's not like, just people dying or, castles crumbling type of changes.
I don't know. I think book three is about brutality. It's about raw brutality and how it changes everyone. The war is on. I mean, it's like, everybody loses everything.
But also, big, significant story changes that are really twist the whole idea of the story happens in these, I guess, these two seasons.
Yeah.
Like, we have now seen since the beginning of the dragons that strange things are starting to happen. We see more and more magic. Right. Well, in this coming season, wow, the strangeness is amplified, in my opinion.
Right. One of the interesting things also is that the book three started the thing that really cemented Game of Thrones to me as better than the Robert Jordan series. Remember, at this point in time, when I was reading book three for the first time, Robert Jordan series was, I think, on book six or book seven. And the Robert Jordan series was what had gotten me into Game of Thrones in the first place. And I remember reading book three and going, oh my God, this is a far better series, because there were people that I absolutely detested in the first two books, and suddenly here I was in book three liking them.
Right.
And hating yourself for it.
And hating myself for it, and feeling a little dirty about it.
Right.
I'm really interested to see what they'll do, because one of the things that drove me a bit crazy about the first two seasons was that there were people there that they were trying to make me like.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to like them. I didn't want to like them. I liked them being big bad guys. I liked them being malicious. I liked them being evil, because I knew what was coming was a wonderful turn.
I probably disagree with you on that point.
Okay.
I feel like that the series has had a chance to correct some things that I think George R. R. Martin has been very good about making well-rounded characters. And what I mean by that is just making complex characters where they aren't all cackling evil things. Although the show has done the opposite to one character. George R. R. Martin did nothing to help Joffrey out by making him showing any type of bright side to that character. And I think the TV series has made it even worse. I mean,
I agree. And Joffrey is irredeemable at this point. Like,
yeah,
he's also a little mwahaha. I mean, which is one thing that bugs me, is he's a little bit, mwahaha. I mean, he's always like, I will make it all burn, and you can't, and it was really like, oh okay. I don't think you need to do that.
Let me ask you this, though. By the same token, in Game of Thrones, doesn't Joffrey serve almost the same function as a comic relief?
He does some, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost something about him that gives you breathing room on some points, where he's so evil that it actually allows you to breathe a little bit at some points, because there's something simple about it, something easy about it.
That's interesting, Don.
And I I never really thought about this until just now, but I think that actually is the case for me.
I think, I think you're right. I would agree with that.
That's and very interesting.
There's actually a few points where, just like the comic relief in some series, has these points of seriousness, these points of introspection, where you see this sort of depth. I'd say there have been a couple points in the series where you've had moments where he had these opportunities to turn, these opportunities to show a higher self, where instead he showed extreme cowardice or extreme cruelty that served the same purpose. Like the moment with the horror and the scepter that was just so incredibly horrible that that I was chilled. Or the moment
really, I wasn't chilled. I was like, really, really, yeah, okay.
Oh, that actually pretty was awful to me.
Yeah, to me, I thought it was that shook me pretty deeply, actually.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I felt like they could have gotten there without going that far.
Well, the other thing that's interesting,
I hated him just fine in the book, and he never did that. So.
The other thing that was that's interesting is that in the last season we got to stick with some characters that were absent in the book, like Robb Stark, and in book three he is actually written into book three, so he gets to actually get back on track with real George R. R. Martin scenes.
Well, right. And also his love is explored a little better in season two in the TV series, which I found to be in a much more engaging love arc than in the books.
I agree. I think that was a misstep by George R. R. Martin to deal with that in the second book, and I'm glad to see that they kind of made an adjustment that they had to do. There's no way you're going to do a TV season and just say, oh, you know what, you're not going to see this actor or this character for the entire season. You just can't do that,
right?
And I think, you know, but it will be interesting to see, you know, those scenes that we've seen in the books actually now play out, because we're back on track of seeing like canon George R. R. Martin version of Robb Stark instead of the.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing that I've always loved is because I've read the book so many times that I know when George R. R. Martin's lines are coming out of people's mouths.
Right.
And every time one of his arias, one of his big speeches comes out of somebody's mouth, I love it. It just makes me so happy. Like the what was it, the knight, the money lender, and the some, I can't remember that whole speech about
who
holds the power,
right?
You know, and I love that speech to pieces. And so when that speech finally came out of Littlefinger's mouth, I was like, you know, yeah, brilliant. You know,
who's fiddling with their mic?
Wasn't me.
Not me.
Yeah, I agree. So we'll start seeing more of that coming out. We'll see George R. R. Martin's words come out of Robb Stark's mouth nowadays.
Can't wait.
Yes. Do you guys agree that they needed to break this book into two seasons?
Yes.
I don't see a way around it.
Yeah. Like I'll be interested to see what they end up. Where they end up breaking
I think we all know where it's going to break.
I don't know.
they have to.
I don't know. I really don't know.
My big concern is if they break at the particular point that we're discussing, which
no
we're not spoiling. Oh, God, this is going to be such a boring episode to anyone who hasn't read the books. I'm concerned that it's too late in the book. There's just not going to be enough.
Well, remember that
for the second
it is, it's very late in the book.
But that's, you know, that's also the opportunity to start working in season four.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
and you know, we all, and in my opinion, book four and book five needs to be, of course, you know, put back in chronological order, and then also tightened up. They need to cut the fat.
You don't want chapters about Darkstar, do you, Aaron?
I just, you know, I don't need to see so much traveling.
Well, and let's face it. I mean, as much as I enjoyed the Arya chapters in books 4 and 5, honestly, they could be condensed into maybe 2 episodes. You know?
Yeah.
Oh.
No, it's true. Come on.
I know, but you're making me sad.
So redundant.
It's because it's character development.
Yeah. All right. Well, so now they know that Arya survived.
So, getting to the George R. R. Martin episode. This was done. Do you remember what year? Anybody remember?
2006. I don't know. I want to say
I'm
six.
I'm not absolutely sure, but this was done a year or a year and a half before they announced the HBO series.
Mm-hmm. I believe we were between books 3 and 4.
Right.
So we had not yet read book 4. And right. We were interviewing him in a small room above Comic-Con in San Diego, while thousands of geek boys were milling about outside the doors trying to get at him, but we had him all to our little selves.
Yes. So 2006, yeah, was when we interviewed him.
2006. Which makes me think that he knew he was talking to HBO at that time.
Right.
He probably didn't want to get his hopes up.
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah.
Well, he got burned pretty bad. Awesome. All right, well, let's go hit that interview.
All righty. Well, I don't think we're going to come back. We'll just go to the interview, and then that will be it.
All right, enjoy.
I can't wait for Sunday.
Yeah.
Sunday!
All right, I'll see you guys later.
Okay, bye.
All right.
Here we are. It is Matt and Pete with Geeks On, and we have with us George R.R. Martin.
Yes, George R.R. Martin. We are very excited about this.
The creator of the Song of Ice and Fire series, Game of Thrones, Clash of Kings.
Wild Card. Fever Dream.
Man. What else? The Outer Limits, Twilight Zone.
Beauty and the Beast was...
Beauty and the Beast, man. I mean, just that alone. Was something. Actually, I had a question specifically about Beauty and the Beast. I noticed that you have this thing in Game of Thrones, in the Song of Ice and Fire, where basically you have hidden worlds within worlds. The reveal of magic slowly coming in as slowly seeping into the world. And I noticed that theme as well in Beauty and the Beast. Is that something that sort of is a theme that's important to you, or is it something that just happened to happen?
Well, my version of Beauty and the Beast really didn't have much magic in it. I mean, there was the hidden world below the sewers of New York, but we never really explained Vincent's origins, and he was the only overtly fantastic element in that show. But I do think that magic needs to be handled very carefully in fantasy. I gave a lot of thought to it when I did Song of Ice and Fire, when I began it, going back to look at Tolkien, because I think magic is something, you know, you need it for fantasy. I think without some magical element, it's not really fantasy. But on the other hand, it's very easy to use too much of it. And if you use too much of it, it spoils the whole stew. It's like salt, you know. A little salt makes it taste good. Too much salt, and all you can taste is the salt. And that's the case with magic.
Now, with the magic within these pieces, it's sort of come to a crescendo so far. Now, with your last book, it was sort of a half a book. I was noticing that with this half a book, you sort of stayed away from Daenerys and stuff like that, who I sort of treat as the overtly magical characters within the story.
Well, she has the dragons, and the dragons are probably the single largest magical element in the story, and also, of course, a linchpin of the magic in the entire world. The fact that the dragons are back is one of the things that's, you know, are the dragons back because magic is increasing, or is magic increasing because the dragons are back? I leave that question open for the characters and the readers both to ponder. But Daenerys not being in the book was simply a case of the length of the book. The book was not done yet, and it was getting monstrously long, and it was pretty clear that I either had to make very, very deep cuts in the book, which I didn't want to do. I felt it would lessen the book, or I had to divide it in two in some manner. One of those would have been to simply divide it right in the middle, just to take the first 1,300 pages or so and say, okay.
1,300 pages?
Yeah, the first 1,300 pages, yes. Just to take that bit and say, here's the book, and then the rest will be in the next book. And, you know, that would have had all the characters, but their stories all would have sort of been interrupted halfway through.
If you're writing 1,300 pages, how many pages do you write a day?
Not enough. That's why the book was 5 years late. I need to write more pages a day, obviously. So instead, we divided the book by character. And Danny, since she's on another continent, she's thousands of miles away from all of the other characters, it was very easy to remove her, because removing her story did not impinge directly on any of the other stories. And then I removed a few other characters who, for one reason or another, were also separate from what turned out to be the main action of A Feast for Crows, which was all of the action around King's Landing and the throne ruling the kingdom, the competition for power.
Now, you have this really interesting thing that you do with your writing, which is you have this ability to do these awful things to the characters that we love and the characters that you love. And in fact, this is a wonderful thing. This is what seems to make it so compelling. Could you talk a little bit about where that comes from and why you do that?
You know, it's funny, because that's gotten a lot of attention in terms of Ice and Fire. But it's not by any means new to Ice and Fire. I've been killing characters my entire career. Maybe I'm just a bloody-minded bastard. I don't know. But if you go back to my first novel, Dying of the Light, which came out in 1977, you can see a very important character in that book dies halfway through, which hopefully was somewhat of a shock to the readers. And, you know, we certainly did it in Wild Cards.
Wild Cards was everybody dying. Like,
not everybody, but certainly many people, and ones you didn't expect. I mean, we killed he was a relatively minor character, but he was a little kid superhero called Kid Dinosaur, who was killed in the third book. And boy, did we get letters about that one. The fans were very, very upset that we killed a little freckle-faced kid. But we were trying to make a point that it was a very realistic book, and you know, this is not the Marvel or DC universe where people can die or get tremendously beat up and come back the next week. You know, if your arm gets ripped off or something, you're probably going to die and you're not going to come back. And it's a dangerous world to play in.
Well, that also
funky 13-year-old kid, you know.
Well, in both those stories, that adds an aspect where I think it makes me care about the characters more, because I know they have a definitive mortality, and that if they end up, you know, my friend Scott actually cracked me up, because when he read the third book, he calls me up in the middle of the night, and he goes, "Have you read it?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I put the book in the freezer. I couldn't deal with it. I had to put the book in the freezer." And that was such a, you know, because he had cared so much about the character and he had cared so much about the events that he had to put the book in a freezer to deal with it.
As a writer, my goal, which I'm never going to achieve, I know that, and no writer can achieve it, but my goal is to almost make you live the books. I want you to forget that you're sitting in a chair with a bowl of potato chips by your side reading these pages, turning pages and decoding these symbols of words, black words on white paper. I want you to fall through that page and feel as if these things are happening to you. That's the goal, vicarious experience when you're reading a book. And that includes the full range of emotions, including suspense and fear. Real fear, and you know, there's a difference when you go on a roller coaster. You go there for the thrill of being afraid, but you're not really afraid on a roller coaster. I mean, if you talk to someone who's been in a situation where their life was actually in danger, talk to someone who's been in Iraq or in the older days in Vietnam and had someone killed next to them or thought that they were not going to live out the night. Talk to someone who's been mugged at knife point in an urban setting or who has someone break into their house. There's an order of fear there that's very different from the fear you feel on a roller coaster. And that's the kind of fear I want to engage from my book, because I think it's so much stronger here. One of them is weak tea, and the other one is you know, strong Irish whiskey here. And I want to serve the strong Irish whiskey. That means when my characters are in danger, I want you to be afraid to turn the next page. I want you to say, you know, goddamn, is Arya going to get out of this situation? You know, and the only way to establish that is to establish very early in the book that sometimes they don't get out of this situation. Sometimes it's too much, and the characters do die, that anyone can die, and the peril is real. And to that mind, you need to show right from the beginning that you're playing for keeps.
Wow. Now, in terms of having been a writer for a long time, can you talk a little bit about some of the lessons you've learned along the way and how your craft has developed?
With the lessons I've learned along the way, nobody knows anything. That's as William Goldman once said in his Adventures in the Skin Trade. That was specifically of Hollywood, but I think it's true of publishing too.
Skin trade or screen trade? It's kind of actually the both.
Yes. You know, there's questions, there's career type questions about that, and there's publishing type questions, or artistic type questions. And as you learn things all the way, you find your own voice. I think when I was beginning as a writer, I had stories I wanted to tell, but I didn't really have my own voice yet. I had certain ways of looking at things, and but I did a lot of collaborations. I was always trying new styles. Well, let's try a story in first person, see how that goes. Let's try a story in second person. Boy, that's weird and experimental. Let's see if that goes. You know, you're assembling the tools. You partner up with a young writer who's a friend of yours because they have a different style that you do. You can learn things from them. They can learn things from you. You try different stories. Let me try a horror story. Let me try fantasy. Let me try science fiction, mystery, whatever it is. Let me try to mix and match the two. But at a certain point, when you've been in the game long enough, that process sort of comes to an end, and you do sort of develop your own voice. And now you've mastered the tools. You know how to use the hammer. You know how to use the chisel. You know how to use the saw. And it's just a question of making good stuff.
What was the first story that you actually sold?
It was a story called The Hero, appeared in Galaxy magazine in 1971. I wrote it actually for a creative writing class in college. I was interested in writing even, well, since I was a kid, actually, since I was very young, but it was certainly clarifying as something I might want to pursue as my career. As early as high school, I was publishing little amateur superhero stories and comic fanzines, and of the time, which would be incomprehensible to guys your age. They were produced by high school kids, largely, and sold for quarter. We called them sticky quarters because you'd take the quarter and you didn't want it bouncing around loose in the envelope when you mailed it to someone. You know, there's no PayPal in those days. So you actually had to mail the guy a physical quarter. So you put it on an index card with a piece of scotch tape so it wouldn't move around, and mailed it through the mail, with a 4-cent stamp in those days. So, and then when he got it, he got a sticky quarter. That was his payment. And they were produced by Ditto often enough, which was this horrible system of reproduction that involved the jelly and pans and things like that, and produced in this kind of faded purple print. But that's what all the comic fanzines were done in, and that's what my earliest stories were published in.
Wow, that's so cool. Now, when you're writing, how much of the story do you see when you begin your very first book? You know, like, how far into the entire cycle do you know, and how much of it do you sort of like allow to grow as you go along?
I generally know the broad strokes. I mean, I like to use the analogy of a journey. When I start a book, I know where I'm going. I know the destination of the journey. Like if I'm going from New York to Los Angeles, I know I'm going to wind up in Los Angeles. And I know the principal routes that I'm going to go. Okay, I'm going to go through Chicago. I'm going to go through Denver. I'm going to take this, that, and the other thing. But I certainly don't know what's around every bend. I don't know where I'm going to stop for the night. I don't know what hitchhikers I might pick up, or what interesting roadside attractions I may stop at along the way. So there is a certain sense of adventure that comes out in the writing. And sometimes you do change the destination. Sometimes you get to Chicago and decide to, you know, go south instead of further west, and he wound up taking a different route or going to someplace totally different entirely. That doesn't happen very often, but it does happen once in a while. But that's just me. I mean, there are many different kinds of writers. I like to use the analogy of architects and gardeners. There are some writers who are architects, and they plan everything, they blueprint everything. They know before they drive the first nail into the first board, they know exactly what the house is going to look like and where all the closets are going to be and where the plumbing is going to run. Everything is figured out on the blueprints before they actually begin any work whatsoever. And then there are gardeners who dig a little hole and drop a seed in and, you know, water it with their blood and see what comes up and sort of shake it. They sort of know what seed they've planted. They know whether it's an oak or an elm or a horror story or a science fiction story, but they don't know quite what shape it's going to take or how big it's going to be, etc. I'm much more a gardener than an architect.
Along with that, Don's here! Don! This is Don, another member of Geeks On. Along with that, when you're writing a story, like my grandfather wrote a huge novel, and he had, when at his death, we found that he had had, actually great-grandfather, he had had something like 10,000 pages of backstory, which he had done. How much work do you do behind the scenes in order to keep what you have and that you're going to present to your audience?
Not nearly as much as your crazy grandfather. You know, you do some. You have to do some. But to a certain extent for myself, and I suspect for many contemporary fantasy writers, there's a certain amount of sleight of hand going on. We're working like in the Hollywood tradition, where we have a nice front on the building, but behind it is just boards and you know, it's a false front. It's not real. Our icebergs, three quarters of them aren't below the surface. They're just floating on a board on a raft there. I mean, yes, you get obsessive like Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien is a great example of this. He worked his entire life on Middle-earth. He started writing the Silmarillion when he was in the trenches in World War I and was still writing it when he died in the 70s, and it had to be finished by his son and Guy Gavriel Kay and other people. But Tolkien was not a professional writer, and he was an Oxford don. He was a linguist. His passion was actually the languages, and the stories were almost a secondary byproduct of his obsession with creating a mythology for England and doing that. And of course, he had a career and a salary as an Oxford don, as a teacher. That was his actual profession. I think for a professional writer like me, I can't afford to take 30 years to work out the languages of Westeros. I have to publish an occasional story if I want to not wind up homeless on the streets. So I can't do that way. I get occasional letters. I could get a letter a few months ago from someone who wanted to know if I could provide a lexicon of High Valyrian, so they could work out some of the structure of how the language worked. And I had to reply, you know, you do seem to have mistaken me for Tolkien. You know, I've invented like seven words of High Valyrian, and when I need an eighth, I'll invent that. But I'm not going to take out a month to work out an entire fake language of something that even in the book is a dead language.
One of the things that I've noticed about your writing is how wonderfully you create your characters and how great your dialogue is. I mean, it's exquisite. And I wonder if your work in film has informed that, do you think? And yeah. Care to comment?
Definitely. I mean, I spent 10 years in Hollywood.
Are you okay?
No.
But
in some ways, Hollywood was good for me. In some ways, it wasn't good for me. I know that was a joke, but that you could almost give a serious question to that. Hollywood is a fascinating experience. It's an adventure, but it can devour you, and it's very, very stressful.
Especially writing for a television show.
Yes, but actually, when I look back on my 10 years, I like I spent the first five on television shows. I spent 2 years on Twilight Zone and 3 years in Beauty and the Beast as an actual staff member, you know, producing scripts, and it was very stressful. But the cool thing was about it is, you know, you went through all the hassles, you went through all the grief. You had many weekends that you had to work all weekend. You had nights you were there till 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night rewriting a script because it was seen at a shoot tomorrow. But at the end, they filmed these episodes, and they came out, and millions of people saw and enjoyed them. My second 5 years in Hollywood, I had climbed the Hollywood ladder sufficiently high that I was now in development. I was coming up with ideas for pilot shows of my own. I was writing feature films. That was actually more lucrative than working on a show because you're higher on the food chain, so you're getting bigger fees because you have all these credits now. But the problem is it is so little gets made. So you work on a project for a year, and then for one reason or another, they decide not to do it, and you're on to the next project. Now, there are some people out there who are very happy with that. They sit around their kidney-shaped swimming pools, and they collect their big checks, and they don't care that nothing has ever been made. But I couldn't take it. I had 5 years of it. I was just crazy. I was spending a year of my life. I'm putting my heart and soul into some of these characters. No one ever sees it except four guys in a room. And then someone who's not even in the room decides that, no, it doesn't fit their current profile or what they want to make, or there's a personnel change. Or there's a million reasons why things don't get made. So at the end, I went back to books. I couldn't take that. But, to answer the actual question, Hollywood was very good for me. I think William Goldman in that book that I mistitled before, Adventures in the Screen Trade, which is a terrific book. When I first got my first television job, which was almost an accident, I asked my Hollywood agent at the time, who was an old-timer named Marvin Moss, if there was any good book I could read about television writing and screenwriting, and he said, read that one. And, it's not at all a how-to-write-a-screenplay book. It's really sort of an autobiographical book about Goldman's adventures in Hollywood. But, he does have two rules there, and one of them is that nobody knows anything, and the other one is that structure is everything. And I think working in Hollywood definitely improves your structure. You have very tight structures on these things. You have to be an architect to an extent. And I think I was even more of a gardener before Hollywood. And I had to get a little architecture there in my thing to do these outlines that they would be approved so I could go to script and learn how to work up act breaks and things like that. And then the other thing that improves is your dialogue. My early scripts were full of, long people giving long speeches, and they didn't even have to read them. I mean, the directors and the actors would just look at them and see a half-page speech that someone's giving and say, no, this is, they want like two lines, back and forth, sharper dialogue. And of course, I learned to do that, and I got better at it as I went on. And it is a better way to write dialogue, I think, than having people give soliloquies like Hamlet all the time. So Hollywood improved my sense of structure and improved my dialogue, and it probably aged me 10 years prematurely.
So were any of the stories that you thought up in Hollywood and didn't get to do, did they end up in actual book form?
No, not yet. I occasionally think about that. We're doing this. I'm not sure if your listeners know this, but we're doing this here at the Comic-Con in San Diego. And I've been having meetings all weekend with people who want to do comic projects. And some of those old scripts might actually make pretty good comics. The comic script form and the television movie script form are not that terribly different. So you can make the transition fairly easily, and they're both visual mediums, although different in significant ways, but still they're both different from books in that you need some kind of colorful image that keeps the eye busy while the ear is listening to the words. But there's still part of me that would love to get some of those stories out there, either in book form, in comic book form, in television form, in some form, because I did pour years of my life into some of these stories and characters, and it's a little sad when you go back and say, oh, no one ever got to, I did this cool character, and this is a nice thing, and no one ever got to do it except those four guys in that room, and it's sort of sad, but it's difficult, too, because sometimes the ownership situation is cloudy. I mean, everything is a collaboration in Hollywood. You're hired by a studio, they give you, you know, six figures to write something. Even though you invent all the characters, each deal is different. So it's not even as clear cut as that. There are things turn around, and you know, what if they give you a one paragraph thing to start? There's a thing called separation of rights. So every situation is different, and sometimes it can be very difficult to disentangle the rights to that.
Speaking on this specific topic, I have a question about wild cards, because I think I would love to see that as a movie or a series.
A series.
And my question for you is, I've heard that, you know, obviously you have a lot of writers that contributed. Has anyone ever approached you about that, and what are some of the pitfalls or reasons that it has not been adapted yet?
Well, Wild Cards has, there's always been interest in Wild Cards for television and film. Going all the way back to, I mean, Wild Cards is a project that's been around for quite a while. We started it in the mid-80s, so it's 20 years old now. And we've published 17 books. There's been a comic series. There's been a role-playing game. And there have been a number of movie options. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was under option for 4 years by Touchstone. And Melinda Snodgrass and I collaborated on several drafts of a script for Wild Card. Wild Card is a whole universe. It's like the DC universe. So there are 50 characters. There are 30 different writers involved.
Who do you centralize on?
Yeah, you got to make that call. So Melinda and I, for our script, chose our own two characters, her character, Dr. Tachyon, and my character, the Turtle. And we built our script around that. And we developed it for, it was initially Hollywood Pictures, and then it became Touchstone, both of which are divisions of Disney. And for a while, it looked like it was going to go, but then there were changes, and of course, it didn't go. Wound up getting put out in turnaround, which means we have some rights to it, they have some rights to it. If anybody else wanted to pick up the actual script that Melinda and I wrote, they would have to pay back Disney the money that they invested in that script. That's why it's turnaround, so it makes it a little harder. Now, since that time, there have been several subsequent options. We have the underlying material. The books are free and clear. Anyone in Hollywood can purchase the rights to them. It's just a script that's in turnaround. So, but also it sort of encumbers me and Melinda, because if we were to do a script, if either of us was to do a script, we couldn't really use our old Disney script. And we probably couldn't use those two characters, because Disney would say, look, you're just rewriting what you did for us, so therefore it's turnaround.
Even though you created the original?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not clear-cut. This would be something for a court of law, but you don't want to get into a lawsuit about this. On the other hand, we could sell the Wild Card universe to, say, Universal or Paramount, and they could do a script, hiring someone else completely unrelated, or even hiring me and Linda, as long as we made this one about Fortunato and the astronomer. Okay, it's clearly it's from the same property, but we're using different characters. There wouldn't be any question of turnaround there. So that's sort of the situation. But Wild Cards is coming back, I'm very pleased to say. We've just sold 3 new books to Tor.
Great.
We'll have volumes 18, 19, and 20 will be out in the next few years, and if they do well enough, we'll have a whole Wild Cards revival.
Will these be multiple writers? Because I noticed that Melinda, I guess Melinda wrote a bunch of books herself.
Just one. Okay. Yeah, we did 17 volumes of Wild Cards in print to date, 12 from Bantam Books. And 2 of those 12 were solo novels. Melinda did volume 10, was a solo novel by her, and Vic Milan did volume 12. And then we did three books with Bain, which were all multiple writers. And then there was a 7-year hiatus, and then iBooks brought us back, and one of those was a solo novel by John J. Miller. That was the last one out, volume 17, Death Draws 5, which came out about 2 weeks before iBooks went bankrupt. So if you haven't gotten that one, pick it up very soon now, because it's going to be the rarest wildcard book, and I expect the value of it is going to start skyrocketing, you know, because when the company goes bankrupt the week after publishing your book, it's not a good thing. But Tor has stepped in, and the new series is going to be all new characters. I mean, unlike like the Marvel and DC characters that are going on down below here at this convention, our characters are very much tied to real time and real history. So it dawned on us we had a lot of 60-year-old superheroes kicking around in the wild card books. They were getting a little gray and paunchy. So we said, let's you know, those characters are still there, the ones who didn't die horribly, but let's explore the next generation. The 19 to 20-year-old kids have grown up in the Wildcard universe.
Or Croyd. Who's...
Well, Croyd is a constant, yeah. Croyd will always be kicking around. And there are a few others. Golden Boy, who never seems to age, is always perpetually 23. He'll probably still be kicking around.
Fantastic. Also, with I had a question about this as well, Pete, which was specifically for Tough Voyaging, which I thought was such a fantastic book. It so deserved to be made into a movie. And is there anything going on with that? Is it a possibility? I mean, anything's a possibility, but...
Well, you know, if someone wants to give me a wheelbarrow full of money, I'll sell them the rights. But there has actually never been any interest in Tough Voyaging.
Really?
Unlike Wild Cards, which has a history of being optioned and so forth. And some of my other things have been optioned. Fever Dream has been optioned. Armageddon Rag has been optioned. But there's never been any interest in Tough Voyaging.
It was so cinematic to me and so simplistic, just in terms of the three. I mean, because it's got three acts. It's like bang, bang, bang. We're going to tell the story of this. And it was basically the corruption of one man. And really watching his corruptive story was so, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it was such a neat story. I was like, this is so simplistically turned into a movie. Why is no one doing it?
I don't know the studios want to do stories about corruption of one man. They want hero franchises where people are redeemed. Also, Tough is a very idiosyncratic character, and certainly 20 years ago when the book came out, I don't think that would have flown. They wanted parts that could be played by Mel Gibson and Tom Cruise, not a really fat, totally hairless man who speaks in very strange, stilted sentences. I've always visualized Tough as sort of a buffer Alfred Hitchcock.
I thought he would be perfectly played by Michael Chiklis. Or is it Michael Chiklis? Chiklis. From The Shield. I mean, he'd just be it.
No, Chiklis is bald, or can be bald, so that might work. I don't know. Chiklis is sort of tougher, has more of an edge. Tough is sort of soft. I mean, that's part of... Right. You think he's a pushover, and he turns out not to be. You know, he's always got his cats, and, you know, there's a little Nero Wolf kind of stuff going on there. But actually, the present climate might be better for it. I mean, we now have heroes on television like Monk, for example, who's completely loony. And so this deeply flawed protagonist who doesn't necessarily look like a matinee idol is actually probably more common today than it was 20 years ago.
Brilliant.
Now, I was lucky enough to be at your reading yesterday where you read the first chapter of A Dance with Dragons. And
you heard of Dance with Dragons?
I did. You guys hate me already.
Oh,
right
now. Man.
And
you don't understand. We're going to take him out back and beat him up.
And it made me start to think. I was noticing sort of your theme of ice and fire and how it's running through your novel. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think about theme before you write, and to what extent does it just sort of evolve as you go along?
Oh, more evolution, I think.
I have to share one quick story with you. I've shared the Song of Fire and Ice with everyone, and everyone's been addicted to it. And for some reason... Oh, I'm spreading the gospel, sir. You believe me. But for some reason, every single person gets to the same point in one of the books, gets to the same point where the Feast of Blood.
And they all read that portion of the book at 3 a.m. Every single one of them, for some reason. And every single one of them calls me up the next day at 8 a.m. sharp, saying, you have no idea how much I hate you right now. How did you get me to read this series? And God bless you, right? So I guess my question is, if I can get that much hatred just from sharing your books, the sheer love that these people have for the characters, the attachments they form, I know I've received an interesting amount of attention from people I've shared the books with. As the father of the series, I've understood that you've had some aggressive fans pursuing you for the next novel. I understand Amazon.com declared a release date long before it was ready.
Release dates. It drives me crazy. I don't know where they get them. They even have page counts. You know, they'll say, yes, it'll be out on September 12th, and it'll be 709 pages. And I'm still writing the thing, so I have no idea how I know it'll be 709 pages. And then when it doesn't come out on that date, when Amazon moves it back, then I get a flood of emails. Why is it being delayed? What's the story? Because Amazon doesn't put out a story. They just change the date suddenly, or they put publisher delayed. They're working on things from publishers, but I've begged my publisher, please don't announce any release date until the book is done and I turn it in. Because if you keep announcing the date, I mean, what happened, the last book was very late. There's no doubt about that. You know, Feast for Crows, the book that I was talking earlier, I divided in two. It should have been in, it took me 5 years between books. I'm supposed to take 2 years, so I was 3 years late with the book, and it was repeatedly delayed and delayed and delayed, and every delay got me tons of email, and I kept banging my publisher, stop putting it on the schedule. Just wait until it's done, and then put it on the schedule, because if you keep putting it on the schedule based on my projections, and then I don't meet the projection, then I get another delay, and I got more disappointed fans, and so forth.
Speaking on behalf of just a bunch of friends that I know who've read the books, we would much prefer that you put out the quality product that you have put out than
I just want to show you this comic. I think you might find it slightly amusing.
It's a comic of a, it looks like Kevin Smith sort of character. So I've got a lot of play.
Yes.
That's exactly the story.
We'll link to that.
We'll link to the comic.
So now, what are you actually here at Comic-Con promoting?
Well, I'm the series, actually, Bantam Books, my main publisher, has a booth down in the big room, and publishers are more and more coming to San Diego Comic-Con. Del Rey's been doing it for a few years. Their sister publisher of Bantam. Bantam came for the first time last year, and this is their second time there, and they wanted to promote Eyes and Fire. So we were here yesterday. We were giving away free copies of Game of Thrones to anyone who wanted one. You know, the first one is free. It's like a crack.
It is like crack.
Yeah. But of course, I have a lot of other stuff going on. I have a Fever Dream comic coming out from Avatar Press. They have a little preview that they're giving. Well, not they're giving away. They're selling it for 99 cents at their booth. A little six-page preview of the Fever Dream comic adaption. And I've been having meetings with various other comic publishers about various other projects.
How did the Hedge Knight, which was a comic, come into being?
It started with these kids called the Dabble Brothers, four young kids. Well, I say kids, they're kids to me. Some of them are in their early 20s, some of them are in their teens. Four brothers, Ernst, Les, Pascal, and David. They contacted me and wanted to do an Ice and Fire comic. And I said, no, I'm not. You've never published a comic. Yeah, you want to start a comic company, but I don't know how you'll do, you know. Nah, you know. And then Les was the one I was mainly hearing from, and he wouldn't take no for an answer. Then he sent me some conceptual art, and I said, this is all wrong, and, you know, I don't like this kind of comic art. Look at this guy, his muscles are bigger than his head, and, you know, et cetera. And But then he came back again with a different artist and said, "How about? Well, yeah, that's actually pretty good. yeah, you're getting it now. You know, but I still wouldn't give him Ice and Fire because it's too big. I don't know how you do this comic, but Les was so persistent. I finally said, "Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you. I wrote this prequel to Ice and Fire called The Hedge Knight. It takes place in the same world, but about 100 years earlier. I'll give you that, and we'll see how you do with that. And you know, if you do a good job, we can talk about other stuff later." So they took it and ran with it, and they published a wonderful comic book. They got Mike S. Miller to do the art. A guy named Ben Avery did the adaption, which was very, very faithful to my my book. And they published this terrific six-issue comic series, which is now a graphic novel. And we're getting geared up to do the second one, The Sworn Sword, which is the sequel to The Hedge Knight.
Is there going to be any connection between those comics and the actual series of The Song of Ice and Fire?
What kind of connection?
I'm not sure. Other than just the worlds, is actually the main character within the first one ever going to take part within or his lineage?
He's dead. He's
no. I mean his lineage because he is becoming a hedge knight.
There are references to
Okay. Cool. Don, do you have one?
Strange question for you, but do you have any favorite sentences that you've ever seen, read, written?
Favorite sentences.
Absolutely okay.
You know, there are certainly sentences by other writers that linger in one's memory, and I suppose you'd call them favorite sentences. In my own work, I don't know. There are certain sentences. I take a lot of care, usually for like the closing sentences of books or chapters, but more particularly books or stories. The final sentence, the opening sentences, those take a lot of care. In a big work like Ice and Fire, sometimes the chapter endings.
Yeah, the chapter endings on Ice and Fire are fantastic. They always end on an up. I've actually had a really interesting experience with that. Is that my girlfriend, when we go on trips and stuff like that, I've read her the first three books of the series so far, and we're on to the fourth book out loud. And so the Song of Ice and Fire really has become a song to me because, you know, I've sort of kept all the characters and what they sound like in my head, and I'm an actor, so I've acted out each individual character for her.
Poor damn soul.
And I've read it to her unabridged, so
it's with him on the train. It's like riding with Sybil.
So it's really interesting for me just how you structure those chapters so that they do always they always end up on this really interesting.
As the Hollywood influence is learning to do act breaks when you're working in television, of course, and act breaks will sometimes kill you when you. What do you mean? I have to have some kind of false cliffhanger here or some moment so we can go to commercial and sell cleaning products. It's a crazy artificial construct, but ultimately, after you get through your first fit of artistic pique about being forced to do that, you realize it's really not that bad. I mean, it's accepting a structure like the sonnet or the haiku. You know, they have a certain structure, and if you want to write that, you work within that structure. And it's a question of are you flexible and skilled enough as a writer to work with different structures? The novel, teleplay, the movie, they all have their own demands.
Wow. When you get inside your characters' heads, and especially when you get inside characters' heads of characters that are different than you are, very different, what is your process of doing that, of finding their voice, of making them real, you know, when they're so unlike you?
That's difficult, but you know, basically, I think we're all human beings, and I suppose it's empathy that comes down to it. You know, it's an imaginative leap that you have to make, but I think it's what distinguishes the best writers from ones that are not perhaps so good. I mean, there are a lot of good writers out there. I don't want to say they're not good, but who write about characters who are essentially very much like them. Even if that character lives in the far future or the distant past or in an alternate dimension or something, they sort of talk like the writer. They sort of have the background of the writer. If the writer's male, they're male. They're of an age with the writer, especially when some of these series began. And they reflect the writer's political and philosophical views. It's easy to do that, of course. That's the simplest thing. It's harder, I think, when you're writing about someone who's not like you. And the more unlike you that person becomes, the more difficult it becomes. Some writers can't make that jump. And I think in particularly in those writers, you definitely see black and white, good and evil. You know, those writers tend to see the world in very simplistic ways, because their attitudes are good and people who oppose them are evil. And you get this kind of black and white thing. Well, I paint in shades of gray, and maybe it's even as a kid I was always thinking what it would be like to be somebody else. How does this feel to this other person? And making that kind of empathic leap. Of course, you're never going to get things right. If I'm writing from a viewpoint of a 12-year-old girl, I've never been a 12-year-old girl. I have been 12 years old, though. I think a 12-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl have some similar experiences. They also have some different experiences, and for that you need to read things written by 12-year-old girls, or you need to talk to the women in your life and say, what was it like when you were 12 years old, and this happened to you, or how would you feel about this? And you have to do that, but ultimately you have to draw in yourself. I mean, the only person we ever really know is ourself. We can base our characters on friends and relatives. We can base them on figures from history. We can base them on people we've read autobiographies of, or biographies, or memoirs, or whatever, which gives some insight into how people thought in other times and other places. But really, down deep, the only person we ever really have a complete understanding of is ourself. So we have to reach down, and there are parts of me in all the characters, whether we're talking about someone like the great and powerful Turtle in Wild Cards, who is probably the closest to me autobiographically. I mean, he comes from my hometown. He lives in the apartment that I lived in as a kid. He has much of my backgrounds. We both had turtles as pets. I just didn't happen to develop any superpowers. Or characters who live in distant worlds and are very, very different, like our girls, or horribly scarred, or our dwarfs. I've never had any of those experiences, but it's empathy that hopefully tries to make them come alive, and an understanding that there are certain things that I think are fundamental to all human beings.
That's great. Just a few things in closing. What three books would you recommend to our readers the most that they should read?
Beyond my own, of course. if they're science fiction fantasy readers, Lord of Light by Roger Zelazny. Probably his greatest book. Something by Jack Vance, who's my favorite living science fiction fantasy writer. Maybe The Dying Earth, which was a very a short story collection, but very seminal in the genre. A lot of subsequent fantasy came out of The Dying Earth. Or the Demon Prince series of five science fiction novels. That's a terrific one, too, by Vance. Beyond that, I don't know, maybe Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. That's another terrific book. But, of course, if you ask me that question tomorrow, I give you three different books. So there are really 30 or 40 books that they should read.
I just wanted to thank you for giving us your time and, your thoughtfulness. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you.